Aloha and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich, and a happy President's Day to you, Chris Vandercook.
Happy President's Day to you, Beth Ann. You know, we often talk about the challenges that the state of Hawaii has as being the only state that consists of islands.
Right. And there are some unique aspects to being on Hawaii Island, as there are to be on all the islands.
Yeah.
But certainly, we're going to find out some of what is challenging the county council on Hawaii Island this morning as we round up all of the county councils that we've been doing over the last week to find out how they're doing and what they're focusing on. And you know that we often say that Hawaii is one state, though the character of each county can differ from island to island. And over the last week, we've been asking the state's county council chairs for the issues that are taking their attention. Today, we're going to wrap up that survey with the chair of the Hawaii County Council, Valerie Poindexter, and she's on the line with us now. Good morning.
Good morning. Aloha.
We often have talked about how, you know, county councils try to now focus on core issues. One of those core issues is transportation. But it seems for Hawaii Island, that is fraught in a different way because of geography than even what Oahu is dealing with because of rail. What do you see happening with transportation, and what's the responsibility of the county council is to its residents?
Yeah, so transportation has always been a struggle for Hawaii Island, like you said, because of our, I think we have the hardest geographical area, such a big island, you know, traveling either from, you know, you look at the Kau residents and the rural pockets throughout the island and the connectivity and or lack thereof, because there is no basically round the island taxi service that would basically go to Kau to pick up people to bring them into Hilo on a daily basis, or, you know, the bus system, which we're working on. We have a bus transportation plan, you know, that we have been working on, and hopefully will come to light very soon. And we'll look at some of the rural areas and how we can start to provide more services, whether it be for kids from the rural area being able to get into college, whether it be, you know, people in rural areas who are struggling with health disparities and need to get in for health services, all of those issues. So, and as you know, the distances are long. So the bus system itself, you know, having more buses and more maintenance, and of course you're going to have more maintenance problems on buses because of the distances that we have to travel. Not only the distances, is the road issues that we also have. So,
right, there's a reason we call it the Big Island, right?
Yes. So you can fit all of the other islands into our island. Yes.
As you look at the other challenges facing the Big Island, and one of them that seems to be moving along differently from other islands is how you're looking at polystyrene. You've got a bill of your own that is in many ways tracking what we're seeing at the legislature. That comes up for at least one hearing, what, tomorrow. Would it make, does it make sense for you to have a separate bill when there's already one that's happening at the legislature?
Well, we don't know if the legislature's one is going to come through or not, right? So we have been addressing that issue from the last term, when Councilmember Margaret Willie had presented that bill. And then it went, you know, to this next term, and now Councilmember Eileen O'Hara is bringing this bill back onto the council. And we've always believed that, you know, the county should have a home rule. There should be some policies that we should take responsibility in. And I think, you know, polystyrene is one of them. We were not successful with the GMO bill. You know that because the rulings came back that the state has jurisdiction over that and not Hawaii Island itself when we tried to put something forward there as well. So I know that we need to work hand in hand with our state, but we would also like to make sure that at some point that we do have control of things that happen on our island that directly impact our people here. So we always talk about having more home rule.
Oh, as you are talking about that, that seems to lead into a conversation that's had every single legislative session about the share that the county should get from the TAT, the Transit Accommodations Tax. That's
right.
Been a bit fraught this year in ways that we haven't seen necessarily in recent times. What happens if this fails again?
Well, you know, we've been, as long as I've been on the county council, I know Transit Accommodation Tax, TAT, has been always an issue in coming before the state legislature, and we've been trying to fight for more of our share because, you know, it's actually established to, you know, help fund the visitor-related expenses, and it was based on the percentage of, you know, earned revenue. So we, you know, if you're reducing the county share of the TAT, it actually cuts the whole purpose for that tax. You know, I think all of the islands, all of the counties are saying the same thing. And this became, I think more of the people of Hawaii County are now understanding what the TAT is. For a long period of time, nobody had that understanding of why it was important to Hawaii County until we brought up the GET tax last term and people came out and fought against us putting on or even having the possibility of increasing our GET for Hawaii Island. Then that's when we said, then we need to start looking at the transient accommodation tax. Then people started to learn about it. And there's still, I think there's a lot of people who still don't understand it. And I think if they would, they would be outraged because there are a lot of services that are a critical piece to Hawaii Island that is used by our visitors.
So, Valerie, I mean, we've heard from at least one county council chair that he views lawmakers in Honolulu as being bullies when it comes to the TAT. Do you agree?
Well, I think I wouldn't necessarily say bullies. I would say they have a strong passion for wanting to keep that money because they too, you know, when you're trying to balance a budget, you're going to look everywhere that you can get it from to be able to balance your budget and work with the governor's office to be able to do that. It's like Hawaii County when our mayor is saying, you know, we had a $12 million. How are we going to, balance that budget? Then we're looking at, whoa, you know, so where do we look for those?
And that seems to be the essential question that all of the counties are looking at, but with different reasons on different islands and different, and obviously countywide.
Right. But I think one of the things that we all share is that we have the visitor industry on each island. They're impacting the services that are delivered to them from the county services. So, you know, you look at roads, you look at beach parks.
Right.
You look
so there should be some sense of contribution to be able to minimize the impact on the residents without putting it on their backs. You're going to have to forgive us. We've got to move along, but we will talk again.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mahalo nui loa.
Thanks so much for joining us this morning. Valerie Poindexter is chair of the Hawaii County Council. She represents portions of Hilo, Waimea, and the Hamakua Coast.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, looking at the impact of jazz education with a longtime observer of the worldwide music scene. But first, your quiz. In today's Backyard Quiz, we thought about a famous artist.
her 1939 visit to Hawaii and her friendship with a little girl. The artist had been described in Time magazine as the least commercial artist in the United States, so some people in her avant-garde circle were puzzled when she took on a commercial assignment. Well, she was shown around Maui by a 12-year-old girl who opened her eyes to the beauty of the island's flowers, tide pools, waterfalls, mountains, and wildlife, and that little girl later remembered her. She said, "You never saw a single tourist in the old days. Even at the most beautiful spots, we were always the only ones there." The result of some of the artist's most celebrated work was what we're talking about this morning, and we want to know who that artist was. If you know, you can call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, and if you're first and right, you get the prize.
Jazz writer Nate Chinen grew up in Hawaii, the son of Waikiki entertainers Teddy and Nancy Tanaka, under the spell of a thriving local jazz scene. His fascination led him into a career as a writer for the New York Times and Jazz Times magazine. Jazz is widely taught in schools at all levels these days, and that's a far cry from the way it used to be. So as we sat in a Kailua backyard last week, we talked about the impact of taking a vernacular form into an academic setting.
There's an infrastructure nationwide and really internationally for jazz pedagogy and for the teaching of jazz as a language and as a literature. And, you know, like many things, there are pros and cons to that approach. There was a time not so long ago when the common complaint was, you know, a school like the Berklee College of Music is just turning out these people whose, you know, entire musical experience exists within the four walls of a practice room. But there's been a real heartening shift, I'd say, within the last 10 or 15 years. More and more really accomplished working jazz musicians have been brought into the academy. And those jobs are appealing because they're stable and they're steady. And a lot of these musicians are really good teachers and really good communicators. And some of them run their classrooms like bandstands, you know. I think about someone like Jimmy Cobb, who in his time at the New School, mentored Brad Meldow, the pianist, and Peter Bernstein, the guitarist, and John Weber, the bass player, and basically formed a band called Cobb's Mob that just included these players when they were in their early 20s. Brad Meldow is one of the most prominent jazz pianists working now, and it meant something for him at that young age to be playing with the drummer from Kind of Blue, you know?
Of course. And an earlier generation got its experience by being picked up by a touring band and having essentially the same kind of exposure.
And those apprenticeship models, you know, the commercial marketplace really buckled under, you know, many different pressures. And it was essentially recreated in an academic environment. So that's one thing that has been interesting. And you know, in a certain way, you could lament that state of affairs, but I really think that if you look at the tangible results, and if you look at the level of musicianship across the board now,
high school kids can play Donna Lee, Charlie Parker tunes now.
Right.
It's unheard of, you know, 45 years ago.
I would say that in terms of the, in terms of what you need to have at your fingertips and under your belt, the sort of baseline level of competency and proficiency and literacy for a jazz musician today, in certain respects, is way higher than it was a generation or two ago. Now, the difference is that, you know, there was a time when jazz was more of a social music. It was more plugged into,
into dance, for example.
Into dance and into entertainment, you know, into this idea that, you know, when you're playing jazz in a club, like, sometimes people are talking, they're having a good time, they're, you know, unwinding at the end of a long week, and, yeah, and that's okay, you know. And these days there's more of an understanding that this is art. You need to, you know, pay attention, be quiet. And I, you know, there's an argument to be made for either, yeah, of those things. And I think, you know, I think ultimately it all works out. There are environments in which, you know, it really would be disruptive to, you know, not to be paying attention. But I do think that it's important to remember that this music is not classical music. It's, you know, there is an institutional structure now that resembles classical music in terms of the commissioning of new works, yeah, and the support of, you know, of new music that needs to be incubated and composed and rehearsed. And, you know, and that's, more jazz musicians now are composers.
Well, here's a contradiction in academic jazz that has occurred to me over the years, which is that the creators of much of what is the orthodoxy today, Monk and Miles and Mingus, were iconoclasts. And how does the music of rebels become an orthodoxy to be obeyed?
Well, we see that in so many areas of culture, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so many things that were once subversive then become commodified,
yeah, true, no,
absorbed by the cultural mainstream, exploited.
Sure.
So I think that's just what happens with culture. But I do think that at any given moment, there are iconoclasts who are working at a very, very high level. And I could point to, you know, dozens of them today. And the commercial machinery around jazz still favors those innovators from, you know, 40, sometimes 60 or 70 years,
yeah,
ago. And so that's what's difficult, right? When you're, especially now, when almost any music is available at your fingertips, listening through a streaming service or what have you, you know, a young jazz musician has to go up against Billie Holiday and Charlie Parker and, you know, and Duke Ellington, Charles Mingus.
Yeah.
But there is also a younger listening generation who the first stop for them is someone like Robert Glasper, mm-hmm, the pianist, or Kamasi Washington, the saxophonist who had a breakout year,
right,
recently. And you know, this is the natural order of things. Someone who's, you know, like 16, 19, 22 years old, the first jazz that really speaks to them is Kamasi Washington. And through Kamasi, because through Kamasi, they get to Coltrane or Pharoah Sanders,
yeah,
or even Grover Washington Jr., you know,
sure,
who knows? But, you know, there are infinite points of access to this music. And the thing that is the most pernicious misperception about jazz is that you need to somehow do a bunch of homework before you even listen to it, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I think that when you talk about the academicization,
yeah, uh-huh,
I'm not sure if that's the right word.
It is now.
Of jazz. You know, the biggest problem with that, to me, is twofold. It's the disconnection from an audience, and there are, you know, there are musicians who are guilty of that, who don't really think about the audience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they think about the, you know, the mechanics of the music and everything that's going on the page,
right,
and then they think about the internal combustion of their ensemble and, mm-hmm, sort of the rapport of the musicians, and that music is wonderful and beautiful. I,
yeah,
love it, but there is a little bit of sugar goes a long way in terms of engaging an audience, and
sure,
some people do that more naturally than others. So that's one problem for me, and another problem is just this idea that, you know, jazz is basically like eating your vegetables. You know, it's a cultural, it's this cultural thing that you should pay attention to. When really, jazz,
yeah,
you know, jazz has always been at heart, you know, enjoyment. It's been a music that makes you feel good.
We'll return to our conversation with Nate Chenin in the second half of the show with a look at his new role as a public radio jazz host and NPR jazz curator.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tory Richard Limited, celebrating more than 60 years of design for the island lifestyle. Tory Richard is proud to support local community news, public affairs, and talk programming on HPR.
The GET surcharge extension, death with dignity, a minimum wage hike, budget cuts, pay raises. There's a lot of attention on those key issues this legislative session. Bills working their way through multiple committees had a deadline of last Friday to move to their final committee in their originating chamber. Now with a reality check of where key issues are, Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair joins us. Good morning.
Good morning and happy President's Day, Beth Ann.
You too. Well, the GET surcharge, that seems like it's just slipping on through.
Well, I'm gonna put the kibosh on that. It's no guarantee, but it's certainly safe to say that both the House and the Senate have their own measures that they are moving forward. They are different. They're different in how long they would extend that surcharge on Oahu to pay for rail. They're different in terms of how much money is going to go to help state highway funds. The Senate bill in particular is sort of a smorgasbord. It's over 40, 30 pages long, and it has a little bit of everything in there. Certainly, it's going to be slimmed down considerably. But at least as of last Friday, both measures are alive. Whether the two chambers can reach agreement, boy, that's a big question. And remember, the money committees are coming up next.
Jill that's
Kikuta
right.
And Sylvia Luke.
And that's the part, because they might have gotten an easier ride, so to speak, to this point. But what happens when they face the money chairs, that's a whole other issue. But death with dignity, though, for all the years that we have talked about that, we had a number of bills. Well, were there five that were introduced this session? And they also seem to be moving along well.
Well, the Senate is definitely moving a bill along. It passed out of the Health Committee. That was not easy, Ross Baker. It's going to the Judiciary. And there's definitely the numbers in the Senate to pass such legislation. The question is, what's the House going to do? I'm told that leadership is torn. While Joe Suki supports it, there are others that are not thinking maybe this is just not the time, that the numbers might actually be evenly split among the caucus. So we'll see whether a measure can cross over from the Senate and there's enough public pressure for the House to hear it, let alone pass it.
Let's talk about the minimum wage hike. The Senate Bill 107 is still moving along, and that next goes to WHAM. That would bring the $15 minimum wage in 2019, and meanwhile, $12.25 next year.
Yeah, and I've seen one draft that says it'll be more like 2021 that they would raise it to $15. Again, it's the same thing. The Senate is moving forward on this. They seem to recognize that you just can't live on a minimum wage in this state. Maybe $15 is palatable. Again, the House is concerned that maybe it's too soon. Remember, we're still in a minimum wage hike process right now. It's going to go up to $10.10 come January. Some in the House are saying, wait a minute, is it too soon to ask for another wage increase, especially with businesses, particularly restaurants, saying, look, things may seem good on the outside, but the economy has been tough for them.
And we'll see what happens as we start to move into a different cycle. We're going to talk about that a little later on this morning with Eugene Tian from the Department of Economic Development and Business Economic Development and Tourism. Got to say goodbye to you for the moment, though. So much more for us to talk about, and we will later as we move through the session. Thanks a bunch.
Look forward to it. Thanks, Beth Ann.
Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair always has a reality check for us today on this President's Day. Now, the memories of the Great Recession may still be fresh in your mind, but it has been 7.5 years of growth since the economy hit bottom. That said, many people haven't exactly felt that happy days were here again. Maybe life got a little better, though. Now, several economists believe we're hovering at the top of a cycle and about to tip downward. But when that will happen, well, no one can say, though the growth for the state has been slowing. It could be tough to think about the coming recession with current record tourism numbers and building making Hawaii's urban or Honolulu's urban core and some neighborhoods around the state almost unrecognizable. I sat down earlier with Eugene Tian, chief economist with the Hawaii State Department of Business, Economic Development and Tourism, to talk about that timetable that he sees.
Yeah, it is difficult to project how long it will be, but the current expansion started in July 2009. That's why you are saying it's about 7.5 years. the most recent three business cycles in the United States is about 9 years. But I believe although the numbers are mixed currently, the economic indicators are mixed, which means that some positive and some are negative. But I believe that we will be on the top, around the peak, for maybe a few years before it is going down.
When people hear that, and they also look outside their windows if they're in Honolulu or other places, and they're seeing building, they're seeing construction, they are being told that we have record visitor numbers, and that doesn't look like it's going to stop anytime soon. It's easy to forget that what goes up comes down and that we live in a cyclic world. How would you explain some of the issues concerning the indicators as we go forward for the state's growth that seems to be declining as we're also watching visitor arrivals and spending increase?
Yes, the economic indicators, some of them are leading indicators. For example, the building permit. Usually it takes about a year to start when they obtain the building permit and starting the construction project. Usually is about between half and 1 year. That's why in 2016, you see Hawaii's construction, the job count is the peak, historical peak. But the building permit issued in 2016 was down by 18.2%. So the 2016 activity was really a result from the 2015 building permit. That's a leading indicator. But tourism is not a leading indicator. And we still see the visitors are increasing, but increasing at a reducing speed. For example, 2016, the visitor arrivals increased 3%. And this year, 2017, the increase in visitor arrivals will be 1.5%. So you compare with 3%, 1.5%. It's still increased, but at a reducing speed. And also, when we look at the visitor industry, in 1988, the visitor industry contributed about 33%, about one-third of our economy. And currently, the contribution is about 17%. So it's decreased by about half. So when you see the boom in the visitor industry, it doesn't mean that the whole economy will be booming. So we see the visitor will be still a record year for 2017, but we see the economy will be increasing and reducing speed.
Your point is that you have to take some historical perspective to understand that. Most people don't carry around the idea that although visitor industry numbers are booming, it's half of what it was 30, 40 years ago, and that we can't expect it to be at those levels again. How then do you advise people to regard some of these numbers that they see in top line headlines and to be able to put it into their own context in their lives as they look at 2018, 2019, and for many families when there are, you know, big expenditures coming up, maybe college or a child starting school or entering retirement?
Yeah, I think the economy has been diversifying. And as I said, the visitor industry is now contributing about 17%. But we do see the industry is still stable. So there are four industries in the state in the most recent business cycle that are driving the economic growth. So there are tourism, construction, there is health services, those medical services, and there is one called business professional services. Those four industries are driving the economic growth, especially the medical services. Even during the Great Recession, during 2008-2009, this sector was still growing. So we need to look at the overall picture. Although people don't feel that our economy has been really in a position that everybody feels is better off, but because the economic expansion is slower than the previous business cycles, we actually, even for the nation, we haven't seen, for this current business cycle, we haven't seen 3% growth. So it's for Hawaii. So we are growing at about around 2%, 2015, 2.3%, and 2016, about 2%. And this is a healthy growth rate because the last 20 years average is only 1.4%.
So again, to put this into some context for people as they approach this, because you're looking at it at a very macro level, And for most people, they're looking at it from the perspective of, what does this mean for me? As you could give them some advice, what would you say to people as they begin to contemplate what their futures might look like in the context of how the state's growth will be continuing and then decreasing?
Yeah, I think the economy started to see some mixed numbers. And for example, if you look at it, the real estate has been booming for a few years. And for January number, if you look at some other counties, they have declined either in sales or in median sales price. But I still believe this year, 2017, the real estate market will be a good market. It depends on the industry. Even coming out of the recession, we see some industries are really doing good, although construction just recovered in 2015. But we do see the tourism, we do see professional services, business services are really good. But we see some of the industries are still recovering. They haven't been recovered. For example, the telecommunication, the wholesale, the manufacturing, those industries, financial services, they are still recovering. I think in the state, about half of the industries, they are fully recovered from the recession. And there are still half of the industries, they are still recovering. That's why in the state, it depends on which industry you are in. If you are happen to be in the medical services, in the professional services, you feel your business are good. And you happen to be in the other industries which are still recovering, you didn't feel that.
And you may not yet have a chance to recover if sometime in 2018, 19, or 20 that we in fact do hit recessionary times. So when you look out over the next 3 years, what do you see in terms of how people should begin to look at our economy based on where they are in that food chain that you just talked about, whether you're doing well or whether you're still not recovered and feeling like you're being eaten up? How do you position yourself if you're a business that may be not yet in recovery and not likely to?
I think in the future, in the next few years, the economy will be stabilized. Stabilized means that we will be growing around the 2% or close to the 2% neighborhood for the economy. And it also depends on the industry. The neighbor island, they just fully recovered starting from January 2016. Honolulu recovered faster in around 2014. Then Maui about 2015. And by 2016, all the counties recovered. So we expect that the economy will be still growing at a lower rate. We may not be able to see a growth rate like 5%, 6% we experienced in the previous business cycles. So I think we have to be live with this slow expansion and a longer business cycle.
Thank you very much for the time this morning.
Oh, you're welcome.
Eugene Tian is the chief economist with the Hawaii State Department of Business, Economic Development, and Tourism. His office studies Hawaii economic issues, produces the state's official economic forecast, and the State of Hawaii data book.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet and what to look for in our dark island skies. And as usual, we're turning to the expertise of Christopher Phillips. Welcome back. What do you have this week?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here. For this week's Stargazers, look out for the celestial trio of Venus, Mars, and of course the Moon. Venus and Mars are relatively close together in the southwestern sky during sunset. Now, both planets will be setting just around 9 p.m. The moon this week will be a mere crescent, meaning a welcome return to dark skies and conditions that are perfect for stargazing.
Opportunity this week, apparently it's getting people involved in a search for another planet in our solar system. Is that accurate?
Yes, there has been quite a buzz surrounding the possibility of the existence of a large ninth major planet in our solar system. Many solar system astronomers agree that there is growing evidence to support this theory, and now they are turning to the public to help them find it in a project known as Backyard Worlds Planet 9, a citizen science project in which people from all over the world can chip in to help find this enigmatic planet.
How does this work?
Citizen science is exactly what it says on the tin. It's the recruitment of everyday people to help solve some of the big mysteries in science. In the case of the Planet 9 project, citizen scientists will sign up to the website and help classify images taken by various astronomical observatories in the hope that someone will get lucky and spot evidence for the existence of Planet 9.
And where does this whole theory of the Planet 9 come from? Describe that aspect of it a little bit.
The existence of this Planet 9 is due to observations of distant solar system objects that are moving far out beyond the reaches of Pluto. By studying the movements of these objects, we can infer the existence of other large bodies that may be out there in the distant dark of the solar system.
So you're saying that now that technology has improved, kind of like in the same way that we think of Pluto as a dwarf planet, now there's thought that on the outer reaches of the solar system, there could be more planets that we just haven't seen?
Absolutely. We find dwarf planets all the time, and our solar system family is growing consistently.
Officials are turning basically to the public for help.
Now, in astronomy especially, our telescopes collect so much data that it would take years for a single astronomer to analyze it all. And that's why it's important to get the public on side to help us do this. Anyone with a computer and an internet connection can get involved. And you can go to the link on the Stargazer website to take you to Backyard Worlds.
I like that. And it's Christopher Phillips with another exciting report. Thank you.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week for Stargazer.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, providing environmentally sustainable architecture, interior design, and research for projects throughout Hawaii and the Pacific. FerraroChoi.com.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking back to 1939, when the Dole Pineapple Company commissioned two paintings from one of America's most celebrated artists. The artist came to Hana and spent the next 3 months painting flowers, waterfalls, fishhooks, misty mountains, everything except a pineapple. She had wanted to get out in the fields with the workers, and the ad agency wanted a less gritty, more artsy approach. The impasse was broken after she returned to her New York studio, where Dole sent her a pineapple. And when she finally got a good look at her subject, she exclaimed, "It's beautiful. I never knew that." She summed up her visit to Hawaii in the cryptic prose style popular at the time. Quote, "If my painting is what I have to give back to the world for what the world gives to me, I may say that these paintings are what I have to give at present for what 3 months in Hawaii gave to me." While you ponder that classic example of mid-century art speak, we remind you that her name was Georgia O'Keeffe.
And David Dinsmore called us from Honolulu, knew the answer, as did a great many people, apparently, because the phone was blowing up. But he was first, and he'll get the prize. If you have a backyard quiz for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000's Home Edition, an online tool designed for parents to strengthen the school-home connection by creating continuity between classwork and homework. Achieve3000.com.
We continue our conversation with longtime New York Times and Jazz Times magazine writer Nate Chinen, who got much of his jazz education growing up in Hawaii, very much a student of the vibrant local jazz scene. He's taken on a new role at one of the nation's flagship national public radio jazz stations, a role he hopes can direct popular attention to the kind of music that's being made here and at other newly minted jazz capitals around the world. For that mission to succeed, jazz will always need to find ways to constantly refresh itself. We pick up our conversation.
You know, the way I always try to sell it, Nate, is to say you'll never hear anything more exciting in your life than a Charlie Parker solo.
Right.
I don't know anything else that takes you to that place.
But see, you say that, and I do not disagree. At the same time, that is precisely the idea that then can be used to justify an idea that jazz is no longer a living art form.
Yeah,
because if it never got any better than Charlie Parker in 1945,
right.
Then, well, you know, that's a long time ago now.
No, that's...
So if we're talking about an art form that reached its pinnacle, you know, for me, during my grandparents' generation,
yeah.
That's a problem. And I firmly disagree with any permutation of the argument that jazz is dead.
Absolutely.
It's an absolute canard, and it's just a big eye roll that, you know, every 3 or 4 years there's some other piece that,
yeah.
you know, recycles it,
yeah.
you know, using whatever specious evidence is at hand. So, you know, I think there is a way to balance reverence and, you know, deep respect for that tradition and recognize the incredible contribution of the giants of jazz, while still acknowledging that this is a language that, like any language, is subject to evolution, you know.
And maybe you just say, you know, Charlie Parker got to that place, now I'm going to get to that place in my way, in my time,
right.
with my sound.
And to point to a concrete example, and I'm not sure if you ever play audio clips, but, you know, a great example of this would be to talk about Steve Coleman, mm-hmm. who is no longer a newcomer. You know,
right.
Steve is in his 50s, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
He may even be approaching 60. But he is he has become a really important figure to a lot of younger musicians. But you'll never find a bigger Charlie Parker nut than
mm-hmm.
Steve.
Mm-hmm.
He can, you know, he could talk at length. He could analyze any solo,
sure.
you know. But he's absorbed the Parker language so thoroughly, and he's applied it to an entirely new, creative motor.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you would never listen to Steve Coleman and say, well, this is just like rehashing, you know, bebop.
Yeah.
But the language of Parker is everywhere in his music at the same time. And that's, you know, that's the jazz process at work.
You know, it's once I asked B.B. King about his relationship to the music of T-Bone Walker, and basically he described his style as trying to sound like T-Bone and failing.
Right.
And
right.
this is what I came up with.
Yeah.
You know, and then I became comfortable with it because he found out that it was his voice. And I think all one is really asking for is an honest voice.
Right.
right. Not derivative, not old, not tired. But there, I agree, there's lots of room. Nate, before we take too much of your time, I want to ask you about the new radio venture.
Yes. So for the last 12 years, I've been a jazz and pop critic for the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
And for longer than that, I've been a columnist and contributor to Jazz Times magazine. And about 6 weeks ago, I made a big transition. I am now the director of editorial content for WBGO, which is Newark Public Radio, and it's a full-time jazz station out of Newark, New Jersey, and it serves the greater New York area, but it's also streamed online, and so you know it has a national audience as well. So what I'm doing with WBGO is in partnership with NPR. And essentially, NPR's jazz coverage, WBGO has become sort of the lead partner in that effort. So we're doing a lot of work to mobilize our on-air talent and also bring, you know, my editorial voice and expertise into the mix on WBGO.org and on NPR.org. It's been an experiment. We're still, you know, really just kind of testing the waters, but it's already been a real exciting venture. And for me personally, it's been really cool to see all the different ways that we can tell a story and we can expose this music. You know, I've been a print journalist essentially for my
yeah.
entire career for a little over 20 years.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm still doing a lot of writing for to be read. But I'm also working with teams like Jazz Night in America, which, you know, is a radio show that's syndicated, and it's also, you know, got video content. It's a whole new set of tools in my arsenal in terms of how to connect people with this music and how to put it into a context where, you know, you really don't have to be afraid of this. Like, this is exciting. This is accessible. And this is, you know, something that can enrich your life, you know. So that's something that I'm really looking forward to developing with, you know, with all of the various partners that we have in the NPR world.
Idea being to kind of, as a curator of jazz coverage and jazz programming for national public radio stations.
Right. Yeah, so... You know, and there's so many vibrant local scenes. You know, we're here in Honolulu, and I grew up, you know, hanging out with jazz musicians here. And, you know, beyond these islands, most people don't know that there's even a scene, you know. And even in the islands, a lot of people don't know there's a scene.
Much less a really good one.
Right, exactly. Fantastic musicians here, you know. And so some of what I'm interested in doing is shining a light not only on sort of the big names that are, you know, popping in New York City and in cities like Chicago and L.A., but also, you know, really talking about what jazz culture is in this country and you know, the various local scenes that thrive, you know, under their own steam, and then also sort of connect with the larger conversation. And so that's something that I feel like I am much more empowered to do now. Now that I'm with, you know, public radio, than I had been at the Times, which is, you know, necessarily a more New York-centric operation.
Nate Chenin, a 1994 graduate of Iolani School, spent 12 years as a writer for the New York Times. He's the director of editorial content for WBGO Radio in Newark, New Jersey. We spoke the other day in a Kailua backyard, and our thanks go out to the chorus of minor birds that accompanied our conversation. There's a regular menu of events going on in our community, and it can be tricky to keep track. So as part of our new time slot here on The Conversation, we're starting a segment with our Morning Edition host and colleague Derek Malama, who'll join us each day with a look at events going on in our community you might consider under the radar. And some of these really are, Derek.
Oh, yes, they are. On Oahu, coming up tomorrow, Professor Janet Poole of the University of Toronto will discuss the history of Korean modernism. That's happening tomorrow at 4 in the Center for Korean Studies at UH Manoa. And she'll explore the writings of Korean poets, writers, and philosophers from the final years of Japanese colonialism, which ended at the conclusion of World War II.
Proving that if you look around, there's always something to do out in these islands. Yeah?
Oh, definitely. On the Big Island tomorrow, the Friends of the Libraries Kona Book Club meets on the lanai. That's a nice thing to be doing. Kailua Kona Library, and they do that every month to discuss a new book. They're meeting tomorrow at 11 a.m. This month's selection is the winner of the 2016 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction, The Sympathizer, by Viet Thanh Nguyen. It is both an espionage novel and a powerful story of love and friendship.
And it's a really good book, Derek. I happened to read it last year. It really is kind of a thriller with a lot to say about his country. Really good writer.
Oh, I know that Morning Edition did a piece on him recently as well. Also on the Big Island, you can join the Tuesday Sketchers at the Pahoa Village Museum. They always have a live model to draw, so bring your sketchbook. It's from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. tomorrow at the Pahoa Village Museum, and it's free.
And drawing a live model is not as easy as you might think.
Oh, it's not. Okay. I used to do that when I was a kid.
I find it completely impossible. So.
Oh.
Anybody who could do it, I'd take my hat off.
Yes. On Maui, the exhibit The Way of Natural Textiles continues at the Schaefer International Gallery in the Maui Arts and Cultural Center tomorrow through March 19th. A master textile artist, Akihiko Izukura, is from Kyoto, and his project fills the gallery with a fiber installation made entirely of hand-woven, naturally dyed silk.
You know that's got to be beautiful, right?
Mm-hmm. I can imagine it.
Yeah, exactly.
I wish I were there.
Well, we'll have to because it's radio.
I know.
Thanks a lot, Derek.
Okay, thank you.
Derek Malama joins us each day to take a closer look at events in our community that might be under the radar. And you can always find out more about them on our website at hawaiipublicradio.org. Beth Ann, who's your favorite president in our lifetime? It's President's Day, so here's a President's Day question.
Not necessarily in our lifetime. There were several that I liked a lot. But, I mean, obviously, as Washington's birthday falls in this month, I like Washington a lot because he knew when to step away. And that's not something that you normally hear about.
It's not something that the job lends itself to either. No, the reason I thought about our lifetime is that I'm a big fan of Lyndon Baines Johnson, a much derided president who was a very pragmatic and effective occupant of the Oval Office. But I'm curious about I'm always curious about what other people think about that, because you'll get a wide divergence of opinions.
And we all know, too, that very often we have to have the lens of history pulled back, you know, by many decades before we begin to see some of the nuance that makes us change opinion, or at least asks us to question something about a president or anyone else that's in the public eye.
We often find historians taking an entirely new look at something that's gone by, don't we?
We do. And we will take a new look at some other things tomorrow when we come back with you. As you may know, faith leaders around the country have said there'll be sanctuaries for immigrants in their congregations. But what about in Hawaii? Reverend David Gerlach of St. Elizabeth's Episcopal Church will weigh in.
And we'll look at a form of instruction for students in studio music production, a whole different take on how it's taught.
Our time change may have happened already, and you hear us at 11, but one of the same things you can always do is be in touch with us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation, or find me at BKOZHPR.
And past shows are archived under The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll see you in the morning at 11 with more of The Conversation.